This is Ted Tate, station manager at 88.1 FM. As many of you already know, we suffered a major loss at WWER when our operations manager and friend Charlie Wilson died suddenly in early September. Charlie was integral to everything you hear on WWER. He was probably the person most responsible for how professional we sound on the air. Since his death, we've wanted to do a proper tribute to Charlie on air, and this program is the start of that tribute. Before we went on air, Charlie and I had many discussions about the shows we would have. One of the first show ideas we talked about was our very popular Porch Talk program. Like most shows, we wanted to try out the concept with some pilot episodes to see what it might sound like. So, before WWER went on air, Charlie and I sat in a studio and recorded the very first Porch Talk as a concept. After listening to it, we decided it was a bit too techie for the average listener, and it was put on the shelf. But now, it seems an appropriate way to honor Charlie. He was, after all, very much a techie and lover of radio. We now present the very first Porch Talk recorded in 2019, which never aired, featuring Charlie Wilson. All right, we're rolling here. Let's see what we can do. I'm going to have to come up with a little introduction or something. Welcome to Porch Talk. Normally, with this show, we like to sit down outside on the porch and have a little conversation with one of our neighbors to find out a little bit about them. But for our first few shows, we're actually going to sit down and talk with some of our staff members here at WWER. And so it seemed appropriate to actually go into the studio and have a chat. Charlie Wilson is one of our very energetic volunteers who's helped us get on the air, and he's had kind of a wide-ranging career, and so I thought I'd sit down with Charlie and ask him about it. You can read his little bio on our website, but we're going to delve a little deeper and get some color to that those stories.
I was never suspended in school. That story is false. Don't pay any attention to it.
So I started with reading that bio because there, even though you and I have worked together in the past, there are obviously bits of your history that I certainly didn't know. And one of the first things that your bio said and didn't make the cut, actually, was that you as a young boy, you like to work on equipment and on trains.
Yes. So my very first exposure to electronics was wiring HO trains, and there was a companion car race car system called Aurora, and they were both on the HO scale. And I would build a table. I got exposed in Boy Scouts to how to cut wood and build a table in my basement.
Did you get a merit badge for that?
Yes, I did actually get a merit badge for that because I had to fit a big table in a small door. So we basically had it in sections and managed to pull the long 2x4s that were the side supports down and build the table from that. So I built a little mural. I had the trains going around, and in the upper right-hand corner was a little radio station that had a little flashing light antenna.
Oh, nice.
But the part that got me interested in radio was I was really down the throat of WTOP. I lived 2 miles from its antennas, and all I had to do to build a radio was take a bunch of bell wire, wrap it around a used toilet paper roll, and hook it to a speaker.
Because it just resonated.
Yeah, it was that strong of a signal.
Okay, so you were in Maryland.
I was in Maryland, yes.
Is that where you were born and raised?
Yes, that's right, in Wheaton, Maryland.
Wheaton, okay.
Wheaton, next to Silver Spring, and I would ride my bicycle around and peek my nose into radio stations in the area. I peeked my nose into WGAY, which was in the World Building in Silver Spring.
I remember it.
And I was alarmed at the swearing that went on when the mic was turned off. Here's this little impressionable boy of 12 or 13 on my bicycle. And I go up to the 8th floor where it said WGAY-FM is. And they had the door cracked. I guess the air conditioning wasn't working. And the side I could hear was the control room side. And the other side was the announcer.
back in the days when they had separate people. You had union technicians who ran the faders and then just an announcer.
And I would hear the guy say, and today, beautiful music on WGAY. Okay, you, whatever. What the are you doing with that fade? You know, they would just, and all kind of in fun. So I was interested in radio. My father gave me, now this is maybe getting a little techie, but he gave me a six-tube Sears radio. What that meant was it had an extra stage of RF, and at night I could pick up really far away. I could listen to KSL in Salt Lake City on a really good night. I could frequently listen to WFAN or WVAP in Fort Worth or in Dallas-Fort Worth area.
And Skip, as we called it back in the day.
And so I eventually ended up building my own little, I guess you could call it a pirate station, but it was legal in the sense that it was the right power. Lafayette used to make this little thing called a turntable amplifier, and it basically transmitted at 1400. And I managed to get the Pop Electronics magazine a little expose on how to make it a little hotter than, than the 100 milliwatts that it was supposed to be. And so I know of every engineer I know. Now, I don't know of you. I won't single you out on this. But every radio engineer I've ever known at one time in their life had a pirate radio station.
No, I don't think I ever did that. No, I tinkered with some transmitters and whatnot, but never actually tried to broadcast.
This last weekend, I went to my class reunion down in Fork Union, Virginia, and we had set up a little pirate station that was pretty much to code, except the antenna was much higher than the code. It was 100 milliwatts, but it was at the top of a church tower. So we were managing to get through the campus and out a little further, but not much. So one Sunday afternoon during alumni weekend, these two guys in similar matching suits come up the steps to the bell tower where our studios were. And they were hearing the music coming from this. We were donated a voice of the theater speaker, which is what's normally behind movie screens. That was our air monitor. And he says, is that an air monitor? And I was thinking, it's probably not a parent. And he was the FCC, and so was his partner, and he shut us down.
Men in black.
That's right, men in black. Actually, it was gray.
but they said probably polyester.
Yeah, that's true. They said, read this. And it was, we were being shut down and play the national anthem. And basically, they said, we won't give you an infraction, just make it legal.
But they gave you a chance to sign off, though? They didn't just, say, turn off the transmitter.
Yeah, they wanted you to do... They were very nice about it.
Did they want a legal ID before you shut off?
An illegal ID, yeah. We were using the callers WLSD, which nobody in the faculty had a clue why.
Wow.
We were using that. Because it was, early 70s, late 60s. And so he said, just make it compliant, which I did. We moved actually to an unused classroom in one of the barracks and made the antenna 10 feet up where it should be. And it didn't get as far through the campus, but at least it was legal.
Hmm.
So fast forward, my hobby ended up being my profession. I did summer jobs at radio stations while I was in college. And I was either a tech...
So was this also all in Maryland?
This was in Maryland, yep, in Rockville, Gaithersburg, that general area. So I did a little work at WASH, a little work at PGC, a little work at WINX, a little work at what was WJMD at the time, which is now 94.7. They've changed it again.
Okay. They change keep up every, sometimes.
Yeah, every 6 months. So anyway... my first real job, I was hired as a parts inspector at a place that makes microwave equipment or satellite equipment for the government. And so I worked there for a little bit.
But, the backtracking just a second, the bit that amazed me that as a kid you were able to just walk into WGAY and kind of spy on them.
Well, yeah.
Talk about low security.
Well, that was true. They had the door cracked open because I guess air conditioning wasn't working. A couple other places, I would come in and poke my face in the window and wave, and they started to know who I was, and I wasn't going to yell a curse word on the air, so they started letting me in the control room.
They just kind of let you.
Yeah, WDON in Wheaton, and WASH at the time was also in Wheaton before they went down to Wisconsin Avenue.
And so is that how you got these first jobs? Was they kind of already knew you, or...?
You know, it's funny. I don't think anybody that I got a job with knew me from that.
Okay.
I would just go and apply. I would look at the classifieds and, you know, say I'm going to college for this and, you know, can I work for you?
Mm-hmm.
And
Little or no money.
For little, well, as most radio jobs are. That's why I'm in television now to this day.
Ditto.
Yes. So I love radio, but I need to eat.
Yeah.
So I was hired at a company that then produced playback programs for hotels and cable systems that became HBO. Back then, it was called Key Cinema by Motorola. And so we would send by MDS microwave in seven different cities using the MDS transmitters before HBO had their own satellite.
So you had videotapes of popular movies that had just left the theater, I guess, as HBO tended to
do. Well, they were even older than that back then. They were not on regular TV because of either profanity or R rating. So we had Clockwork Orange.
Okay.
We had The Last Tango in Paris. We had those kinds of movies that you could watch on in a hotel room, but not at home normally.
Right.
And so then I went from there. In fact, the building this was in was right across from where Reagan was shot.
The Hilton. The hotel, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this building we were in there moved to Bethesda and was in the same complex as Channel 20 in what was a safe. We actually, our control room, you went through a door that had a tumbler key.
Oh, my.
And not much ventilation. And so that was the next thing. And then at the same time, I'm still working a little bit here and there in radio. I was at WAMU doing board ops and night watch and things like that. And then I was working at a company that installed television control rooms and systems. They were based out of Virginia Beach. They put in most of the Christian broadcasting stuff for the PTL and Pat Roberts. Systems, but they expanded and wanted to add more capability up in D.C., so they opened up a branch in Gaithersburg. But I did most of my work in Baltimore, so that was for about a year and a half. And then I was a member of the SBE at the time.
That's the Society for Broadcast Engineers.
And I was at a meeting, and a guy there named Steve Nelson said, by the way, CBS is switching from film to tape. Give us a call. We need tech heavies to keep the stuff running in the field.
So this is – we're just to explain a little bit for listeners. So back in the day in television, you filmed stuff just like everybody filmed stuff on film, developed it, and that's how it was presented on the air for television. But eventually, of course, as videotape started to come of age – they started switching to videotape because, of course, it had the unique advantage of being able to play immediately. You didn't have to develop it.
Right. You had a 3 p.m. deadline in film. You had a now deadline in video. If you could set up, we had little microwave transmitters that we called them little shoeboxes, and we would send one on the North Lawn and aim it at the Blair House.
Yeah, when you say the North Lawn.
Of the White House. And we would point that at a receiver at the Blair House, and that would go back to the CVS Bureau at 2020 M Street, and we could then do live playback of tape. If we had just done some kind of briefing room spray, we could take the thing outside and play it from this portable 3/4-inch videotape machine. And that back then was just amazing.
Right.
And one time they tried to do a live program But this was before the age of what we call a frame sink, where you could basically lock whatever's coming in to whatever signal you send, so you don't have to worry about is it in phase or not.
Now, just to, again, backtrack for listeners. So this is the problem you get, particularly when you switch from one camera to another, that sort of thing. If they're not all locked together, the picture jumps and looks horrible. And back in those days, could jump for like a second or two
where it would just look absolutely horrible. In fact, it was common practice when it went from network to local to see that roll.
Mm.
Local plans would not gen lock, so to speak, to the network because it would go off. When they were off the air, they wouldn't feed bars all the time. Sometimes they would just disappear.
Mm.
So the houses all ran on their own. And so I got a call from the DC Bureau saying, don't shut off your camera. We're gen locking the network to you.
Oh, wow. And so, which is a big deal, actually.
Which is a big deal.
Techie-wise.
Yes. And so I stayed with them for a while. I was with CBS through 84, 85 and got the bug to go out and learn a little bit more technically. They didn't have the most recent gear in the world. They were a little behind keeping up with the other networks. And this little young startup company that worked right next door that had two employees already from CBS needed somebody to do editing and shooting and things like that. So I went with them for a while.
Now, so that was a company you said, oh, probably in this building, actually.
Actually, it was in 2030.
2030 M Street.
Yeah, called PBS.
Oh, yes, yeah, yes.
With Bob Gravenberg and the two Larrys.
The two
Larrys. Larry Diana, Larry Tyler were the two techies. And so I worked with them freelance. I ended up getting hired by CBS during Desert Shield to work in Baghdad and Jordan before the war started. And then after the war started, I was in Dahran, Saudi Arabia. And so I did part-time freelance editing, sometimes shooting. That was what kind of kept me employed, was that I could do more than one thing.
Right. So just to, again, backtrack a little bit. So you're out in the field of, I guess, Afghanistan, and you're shooting, when we say
Actually, we're talking about video. Yeah,
Iraq. Yeah. Oh, Iraq, sorry. Yeah. We're talking about video on videotape, but back then it's beta. And then you're taking that back to an editing facility and actually editing that video in what at the time was a fairly new technology in terms of editing videotape. Were you actually cutting tape with razor blades and that sort of thing?
That actually never happened with cartridge cassettes.
Right.
That was just with 2-inch tape.
Right.
Which thank God I never was involved with.
Yeah, I've heard horror stories about trying to do that. It was
the thing about editing, if you didn't know about videotape, was in the original days of videotape there was no way to do an electronic switch without it jumping. And what you had to do was make everything from one player to the next recorder totally in sync. And they really hadn't developed that yet, but they had figured out how to literally develop the videotape so you could see the scan lines. And you would put it under a microscope, and you could see where vertical sync was. And you'd line it up with the tape that you wanted to cut to. And
so you're actually looking at the little metallic granules on the videotape and seeing where they line up.
In quadruplex tape, they're fairly widely spaced, so it was not too hard to see. And you could see where basically you had 16 swipes per field.
But this is the cutting you're talking about. That. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I can't even imagine.
Can you imagine Laugh-In was cut that way?
I remember Laugh-In.
They literally used razor blade cutting. What they would do is they would shoot an hour of Henny Youngman doing one-liners. They'd shoot an hour of the Doors opening and shutting. They would do an hour of this, that, the other for the whole season at once, and then go back, make copies of those tapes, and then start cutting them up and making shows out of them.
Really?
Yeah.
So they basically, I mean, other than guest stars and whatnot, they'd have their whole season in a week.
They would basically then get a guest star come in and do 10 minutes, and then
Wow, what an
they
easy...
They do intros and outros and a couple jokes, and yeah, it was...
That's a...
And the guy
sounds
who,
like a cheap show to produce.
Well, the guy who engineered all this was the engineer in charge at NBC when I was freelancing in the 90s, and he explained how all this worked. And back then, there was no network at the time that went from East Coast to West Coast. And so they would then make 7 copies of this show and put it in strategic cities that would then play to the kind of local area networks.
The group, yeah. Because the circuitry, I mean, we take for granted the connectivity that we have nowadays. Mm-hmm. That, you know, I can call somebody anywhere in the world on my cell phone, you know, without being connected to anything. We've got... you know, global satellite news networks and CNN and things like that. And all of this stuff just happens immediately. And we can see anything going on around the world instantly. But back then, you're talking even the network news agencies didn't have complete connectivity to all of their stations.
Well,
they had to transport things. I can remember there was a thing we called the sack or the bag or whatever that they used to send to London on a daily basis, and you had to get your tapes in the bag so it could go to London.
Yeah, the air pouch.
And yeah. And I'm sure you guys did that sort of thing too.
That we have a famous guy in Vietnam who just retired, who was the guy who would get the film on the plane. Was the whole thing that he had to do every day,
right,
during the Vietnam
probably
War.
On a motorcycle or
yeah,
something.
Yeah. Run up to the tarmac. Back then, the security was a little lax. And,
drive your motorcycle right up to the back of the plane.
And then hurl the bag into the plane. Okay, guys, go away. But in back to Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, our connectivity was through a Earth station that was a flyaway that we traveled with.
So then, again, explaining the technical terms, flyaway meaning a portable satellite uplink
system that you could take
you
in
could
a Learjet. Basically, it was designed to go in a Learjet so that you could go to wherever you needed to go in a moment's notice, although there was more in the system than would be in a normal Learjet.
And the idea of portable is a relative thing.
It had a handle. That's pretty much it.
And it was very heavy, I suspect.
And so that's what we would feed on. Also, we had our phones connected, which was kind of cool. My wife could call the CBS Exchange in New York, which is 202,
right,
3 numbers, and then 4, and get me there in Dhahran,
wow,
because that set of numbers was assigned on the PBX to go across. The only thing we had to do is we were on what we called a wobble set. It was all the way at the far end of the universe, and it moved. It was wobbling in the air.
Oh.
It was near the end of its life.
Life.
And so we had to go outside every now and then. The phones would go down. We'd hear them all go up, bloop, like that, and somebody would go out and crank the dish.
Realign the dish. But for that day and age, to be able to talk via satellite is pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was the birth of the Inmarsat phone that you saw Peter Arnett use, and the Beacon, which BBC uses. And there's a built-in delay with that we've all kind of gotten used to. The codecs back then were pretty crude, and so the video quality was very, you know, maybe 150 lines. As long as you didn't move, it didn't look that bad. What would go blurry would be the lifts as you would start to talk.
Mm.
But now the codecs are so amazingly good that you can...
Well, again, you know, looking at the tech, if we're going to talk techie here, mm-hmm, you're talking about the difference between, you know, trying to send something across the world on a satellite and all of the equipment that you used to lug to do that. And I know about that. I've done a bit of it myself. And nowadays, of course, we can go on the air from basically a backpack device that mm-hmm fits on your back that uses cell phone technology to send stuff in much higher quality. Much faster.
So if we fast forward to today,
well,
and you watch a program called Live PD, have you seen this on A&E? It is...
I have not watched
from
it.
From 7 cities, twice a week, Friday and Saturday night, all using LiveView, which is this backpack device. each city has four cameras with one set of cops, and they chase whatever goes on that night. And it's what they call slightly live. They've delayed it a little bit in case something really bad happens. Mm. So there's a little buffer.
Right.
And you also have to get signatures from people before you put them on television. So they kind of get that done first. But now the business I'm in on a daily basis here has to deal with satellite uplinks and downlinks. Well, that's so less used than it used to be.
Yeah.
Because you had to feed your story on the satellite. Well, now you can feed it on the internet.
Yeah, so let's get back to where you were. So you were in Iraq?
I was in Iraq. I was in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia for the second part.
Mm-hmm.
During the bombing of the Al Rashid Hotel, I had just gone rotated out. And my partner was the one that ended up getting stuck there during when the bombing started.
So when you rotated out, you came back to Washington?
No, I was back in Dhahran.
Oh, okay.
We would go back and forth between Dhahran and Baghdad.
Okay.
Through Amman, Jordan was the central point. One time when I went to Baghdad and came back, they lost my luggage. The one plane that goes from Baghdad to Amman, Jordan, my luggage was gone.
Well, I wouldn't put anything past the airlines.
Yeah, I would now.
Even back then.
So they had to get me clothes and everything from scratch. But anyway,
I've had an airline lose my luggage without me ever leaving the ground. My flight got canceled, and somehow they lost my luggage for 3 hours. But anyway, yeah. I think we all have horror stories of that in one term or another. So how long were you out there? That was just a couple of years, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was from. I was actually on vacation when I got a call from the now news director of CBS, Susan Zirinsky, called my cell phone when I was on a vacation out west and said, would you like to get on a plane and head over to Saudi Arabia? They were just invaded in Kuwait. So I went from there to the end of the war, basically, which is about almost like three quarters of a year.
And you're still acting basically as a cameraman and an editor for all of this?
Mostly as an editor, as a backup cameraman, because they have the war cameramen that are always doing that stuff. Mm. But I was scheduled to go out with Bob Simon as the sound man when he got captured.
Mm.
But they had something they needed me to cut now, and so they put somebody else in his place.
Wow.
And I dodged that bullet.
Well, you probably dodged more than one, given your time out there. That's amazing. It makes you stop and think, what if this had happened or if this had happened in a different way or whatever? And it all sort of brings you to where you are today, I suppose. But
well, I came back. I got the itch to buy a radio station. A friend of mine had moved out west and said, hey, you can buy stations out here that are the price of your house.
You know, I guess that's for all the radio geeks that I know, there's always that little dream at the back of their minds that wouldn't it be cool someday to buy my own station and run it? And I'm sure I could make money doing that. And I suspect that's exactly what you thought at the time.
Yeah.
I can program music better than these guys can.
Well, that part was true. I did get very good ratings. I got the best ratings of a small market station.
So this was Casper, Wyoming.
Casper, Wyoming. I had a 22, which was unheard of.
Let's explain a little bit about ratings, because I don't think people know.
Okay, so the rating number is of all the radios turned on, who is listening to what. The share is basically of all the radios available, who is listening to what. So the share number will always be lower than the rating number.
Because not everybody has their radio turned on.
Right. So the highest that city had was something like a 16. The top 40 station had that for years. And so we knocked them down to like a 3.
Oh.
And we were 22.
Ouch.
And then the rest were less than 1. And this
wow.
was in, this was in a
That's
market.
A coup.
This, yeah, it was a coup. This, we were doing oldies and classic rock as a combo. And the it was a 5-station competition. And one of them is a 50,000-watt AM. Everybody who knows the area knows K2 Radio. That's where Pete Williams came from.
Mm.
That was one of the ones that we beat down to below 1. And so ratings are great.
But they loved you.
Ratings are great, but income keeps it going. And the economic times of the times were not that great.
So what year is this?
This is 93 to 95.
Okay.
And so basically, I couldn't see it continuing in a continuous deficit. So I sold it to a competitor who kept most of my staff on, which was part of the deal. Keep these people employed and, I'll sell it to you. So I did that.
Did you make money?
No. Lost my shirt.
Did you?
And house.
Oh.
Yeah. But, I don't regret it. It was fun, being head cheese for a while.
Mm.
Then went from there to a neighboring area, Scottsbluff, Nebraska, worked as the PD of a group of four stations. And this was just when multiple ownership was becoming something of
Stations started getting gobbled up, one
and so this
big
guy,
fish eating the smaller
fish.
This
guy who owned one station bought three other bankrupt stations and put them all in the same building. But it was kind of weird. Nothing was really coherent. It was three or four really separate stations all in the same building.
All with their complete staffs and everything.
Well, and nothing interconnected.
Which is silly because the whole point of it, at least from a modern day perspective, is you save money by combining staffs.
Mm-hmm. So, well, the staff was still reduced, but what you had to do was you would do your morning shift on KMOR and then do your afternoon shift on KOLT.
Mm.
And then you would do voice tracks for KQLT. And so you were used pretty much for 8 hours plus, because you then had to do spots and do other things as well. But the silly part was doing the weather. You would go into one room, hit the automation. We all used a system called Computer Concepts. It was one of the earlier automation systems. And you would go in and you would go to the WEX file and hit record and do your and today this afternoon from whatever, and then finish that, go to the next room and read the same identical thing.
With different call letters.
And then go to the same. I actually got the whole system connected together so that the intro loop had the call letters, but the file just had the weather report.
Mm.
And that way you only had to do it once. And I got it to, I set up a little 286 server so that I could connect them all together.
So again,
286, by the way, friends and neighbors, is before Pentium or any of those chips. Long time ago.
So even when you were acting as on-air staff, you still couldn't keep your hands out of the techie stuff.
Well, yeah. In a small station.
Yeah, you got to do everything.
Well, the joke is, what are you doing? It's sales and. Because everybody's a salesman.
Mm.
If you're answering the phones, if you're meeting or greeting, that's the first face all these people see is the person. So everybody was to be courteous and kind and answer the phone, as though that was a sales call.
Mm.
And so, and being a PD or more of a public face than a normal DJ would be, you're seen more in public because DJs are kind of surly that don't look good in public. That's why they're on radio.
A face for radio, as the saying goes. Did you do public appearances?
Yes, yeah. Yes. We had a mobile unit called the Music Machine. And so we had
a van or something?
Two turntables and a horse trailer.
Oh.
And the horse trailer had two Voice of the Theater, those same big clunky speakers, and what we called the coffin. And the coffin was two turntables and a mixer and a bunch of lights.
Oh, and a lid on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it looked like a coffin.
Yeah, yeah.
You lift up the lid and you can get at all the gear and then you can close it back down for
and
travel.
And you could get it set up and going in about a half hour and you would do remotes. If we did live remotes back to the station, we had this little box that worked off of cue tones and you could hit a button and the DTMF tones would tell the automation back there to take you. And then you would have a window. You had exactly 2 minutes to do whatever before it took it back.
Mm-hmm. I've done similar things.
It worked pretty well. It was phone quality, but that's what you expected back then. So,
well, it was a remote.
Yeah. You're
live. Just the idea of being live from someplace back then was exciting, and people, tolerated lesser quality.
And we did a lot of that for sports because in small towns, sports is everything. Friday Night Lights, we had this whole system where with 1 a.m. station, that was the away game that the other town could hear. And the FM that was local would be the local game or the local commentator for that same game. So you had less coverage at night on the well, the FM local would only go, you know, 4 or 5 miles, but the AM out there would
especially
go,
at night, traveled further.
20, 30 miles easy. Mm. And so that's how we would share back and forth between games.
So did you air the games on both stations simultaneously
yes.
in that way?
Mm-hmm.
I see. Okay. And did you have different announcers on
yep.
each?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so you had the home announcers
the
and the away
right.
announcers. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. As a side item, I'm hoping that WWER will be able to do some of the Drifters games in Colonial Beach.
That would be fabulous.
Yeah. We haven't quite figured out exactly how we'll do that. We're hoping to maybe get the schools involved. Probably not live at first, but certainly recordings. I know that there's certainly a good following of the team sports, so I suspect that if we put it on the air, people will listen.
Or at least had somebody the next day who was part of the involvement, either a coach or somebody who could talk about the people that are coming up.
All we need is a sports department.
That's right.
If you'd like to volunteer.
To go along with our highly paid weather department.
Yes.
So anyway, that is pretty much how I ended up back in radio for a while. I sold the station, came back. I worked for Discovery.
In the D.C. area.
In the D.C. area. Went back to CBS after I had finished that contract. And then in 2007.
Now, what brought you back to CBS? Just that they said, looking for an editor?
They said, so when are you coming back?
Oh, okay.
When I went and visited.
Oh,
and I
right.
said, well, I've got a contract with Discovery. I can't leave for a year. And so they then said, okay, well, as soon as you can, you know, let us know.
We're ready.
Yeah, I had cred, so I guess I was well-liked.
I guess they were looking.
To come back and did that until 2007. And then Rome Hartman started the BBC World News America upgrade here at the BBC. And I was here until...
Yeah, that's where I met you.
Yeah, and I was here until the... BBC crisis of cash killed the show. I was given no assurances that would continue.
Yeah.
And so looking forward, I thought it would be best if I departed and went back to engineering. And so that's what I've been doing ever since.
Mm. Yeah. Oddly enough, the show does continue mm-hmm. on, and hopefully it will continue. We're still proud of it, honestly.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
And in fact, you now have afternoon programs, too.
Yes. Yeah. Out of the same studios, mm-hmm. we're producing multiple programs. So our Washington Bureau is getting more activity. So in addition, you've moved, I guess you were living, when you were working for BBC, you were living in Springfield, weren't you?
Yes.
In the suburbs
mm-hmm.
of D.C.
Yeah.
Now you've moved down to Fredericksburg and mm-hmm. But still come into D.C. a bit to...
Yeah,
to
take the train.
The VRE.
And come in not 5 days a week, about 3 days a week. It's days that are a little long. But I kind of like the lifestyle of having a Thursday or a Friday off that I normally didn't before. Mm.
And Fredericksburg is a nice
yeah.
town.
Mm-hmm.
Not as nice as Colonial Beach, maybe. But
although the drive from Fredericksburg to Colonial Beach is a nice drive.
Yeah.
I enjoy it.
And that's, I guess you found out about all of this from me from Facebook or something
mm-hmm.
like
yeah.
that, didn't you?
Yeah, I saw your posting.
And you raised your hand and said, yes, I would love to help. I'm a radio geek and I still love radio and I don't care if you don't pay me anything. I just want to help
what?
out.
What?
Oh, you
no
didn't
money?
Know that. You didn't know that? So here you are and here I am, and we're trying to produce some programs and make some things that are interesting to listen to. We hope people have enjoyed getting a little background about the people who are working here at WWER. As I said, we're all volunteers and we're trying to produce interesting things that you won't hear on other stations and that you won't hear about anywhere else. It's about Colonial Beach. I know we've talked a lot about the D.C. area simply because that's where you and I work. But Colonial Beach is the town that is
where you it's where you live.
Well, yeah, yeah. And it's where I hope to retire to someday. but I do have a house there now and really enjoy it and when we do another segment about me, I can explain all about how I found Colonial Beach and why this whole radio station thing is important to me. I know it's important to you, and I appreciate all the effort that you've put into helping us make it happen.
It's a great group of people. I'm glad to be part of it.
Charlie Wilson, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ted.
Thanks for listening to this very special edition of Porch Talk featuring Charlie Wilson. As I mentioned at the start of this presentation, Charlie was integral to everything you hear on WWER. He came up with many show ideas and produced a variety of programs that we tried on air in our first year. Grooves on 45, The Tiki Lounge, Medium Rare Oldies, and The Oasis are all shows Charlie created and produced. Oasis was his most recent show on our schedule. As a further tribute to Charlie, we've decided to run previous shows he made in the Oasis time slot. We have an archive of shows he made, and we will rotate these in the Oasis time slot so that Charlie can live on through the airwaves. Please tune in Sundays at 5 a.m. or 9 p.m. and Wednesday at 11 p.m. for a sample of Charlie's archive of shows.